Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Antifada, episode 200 and a lot. It's me, Sean KB. I'm here with AP Andy. What's up, Andy?
Let's go, Mets.
Let's go, Mets. Just won 7-3, grand slam in the second inning. Exciting time to be an Andy. And me, too. I hope the Mets win.
I hope there's going to be a Subway Series.
I would love to see a Subway Series. Last time we had that was the year 2000. It was the dawn of a new epoch, the dawn of a new century, even a new millennium, if you will. And everything was looking so bright.
That's back when we were against globalization. Now we yearn for the return of the rules-based international order.
The dialectic at work.
On that note, we are here with a returning guest, a good friend of the show, doing some remarkable work, here to talk about the follow-up to his Endgame article in the Brooklyn Rail. That is Jamie Merchant. What's up, Jamie?
What is up, guys? Good to be back.
Good to see you again. The follow-up, of course, and I'm going to plug the living hell out of this book, is from Reaction Books, part of the Field Notes series with edited by Paul Maddock. It's a complete book version. It's an expansion upon the essay called Endgame, Economic Nationalism and Global Decline, Podcaster's Privilege. Andy and I were both able to get copies of this book. Love the book. Let's talk about the goddamn book. Anything you want to say? Maybe like what inspired you to expand upon your essay, which you were here, I think, last year to talk about. What inspired you to write an entire book length treatise about globalization, the new economic nationalism, as Andy said, the kind of head spinning turn from globalization to deglobalization?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's just been one of the biggest transformations of our time, in our lifetime, you know, that we've lived through, kind of our generation and those around us. We have lived through this great transformation of not just the global political economy, but like popular attitudes towards it. And this huge, you know, shift in mass belief, collective belief, from something like globalization to now something like this new common sense of, you know, aggressive nationalism. So I kind of, you know, I've been writing about that stuff in Brooklyn Rail for a couple of years, and around 2018 or 2019, Paul Maddock, the editor there, suggested that I try to put a book together. And so I started, and then, long story short, the pandemic happened, and that kind of prompted me to go deeper in this book into some of the like theoretical questions than I had actually originally planned. But yeah, that's the quick story of it.
And the political, you expand upon the sort of political implications of the original article, which I think is really great too. As a form of plug, once more, I'd say that I found this book to be incredibly readable. So if this is the first time people are delving into global political economy, shifts in the regime of accumulation, understanding the connection between politics and common sense and ideology on the one hand, and like the actual mechanisms of the profit system on the other. Awesome stuff, but it's not a simplistic book either. You have some really, really good insights in this stuff that made me say, wow. So you begin the book, I think, very well with an examination of conspiracism, especially the far right's whole great replacement theory, right? I would ask you why this ideology is important to rebut. I think that's pretty obvious, but what social function does this sort of conspiracism play under capitalism right now? And what is like the great reset? What are these people reacting to? What global trends, what economic factors, what political factors are causing this right-wing conspiracism to kind of go nuts?
Yeah. So, the Great Reset in particular is this. It was actually the theme of, I think it was a Davos meeting in 2020. So the year of the plague year, and the Davos elite were, you know, the most powerful people, like, you know, economic and political elites in the world, were talking about the need for a great reset around basically inclusive capitalism. Mm-hmm. You know, what this kind of buzzword that they have been throwing around for the last few years, essentially since 2016 and Trump, and the populist backlash has really set in, you know, the need to like renovate capitalism, whatever, to make it more equitable, to make it fairer. But if you like read the fine details, you know, or sort of read the details of the plan, it's all this stuff about, you know, closer partnerships between policymakers and business, you know, business leaders and innovators and entrepreneurs and stuff like that. And so it's like the actual plan behind the Great Reset was like just basically more of the same, like more corporate domination of public life, more complete corporate domination of political life, and just business as usual, really. But with the added modification that they are thinking, they're trying, you know, within the very constrained parameters of like capitalist elite thought, they're trying to figure out a way to address the legitimation crisis that they're in.
Right.
But that the meme, you know, of, if you like, of the Great Reset went viral.
You will own nothing and you will be happy, right? From the ad campaign.
Yeah. And they'll take away all your burgers and you're only going to eat bugs.
Right.
And
get in the pod.
And like, you're going to get in the pod. And it's going to be a bad time.
And it seemed like the major revolt against it that I first registered came in the Netherlands with like the farmers' protests against, I guess, like what kind of fertilizer they could use or something like that. Did that strike you as like the first big grassroots political movement? I think in your book, you started with Brexit and then the election of Trump. But yeah, the Netherlands is when I first thought it was like a real thing and not just an internet thing.
Mm. Yeah. There's definitely the movement in the Netherlands. And then, of course, the Canadian truckers that same year, right?
Yep.
Like mobilized, and it was this whole thing. And but I don't recall if the Canadian truck drivers were specifically referencing the Great Reset. But,
and they were also, it was also fairly small, like they kind of had an outsized influence because they used their trucks to block a city, but it was like only 5% of truckers that were supportive of it, I guess.
Right. Yeah, it definitely had grassroots like buy-in. You had some of the like, you know, lumpen MAGA politicians talking about it in Congress and whatnot. And of course, people, you know, figures like all the, you know, the conservative shock jocks, Alex Jones and all of that were all over it. And so, yeah. And so that's basically what the great reset is. But it shows you, it's that perfect inversion that really like, it explains so much of the present. It's just like, it's corporate domination. That is this like massive transnational structure, right, that determines our lives and shapes it from a very high level, like, you know, these global institutions that of finance and business, you know, that influence our daily lives on such a deep level. But the way that those structures are interpreted at the grassroots level are so often through these lenses of conspiratism, you know, that reduce everything to this kind of like extreme and sensationalized like morality play, basically.
Right. When you go from the Great Reset to the Great Replacement, which ruling class members like Elon Musk are apparently proponents of these days, you of course add like a racial component, and that racial component also of course becomes a national component, as especially in the United States, the sort of normative civic nationalism is in the midst of all of this new economic nationalism for both the right and the left, interpreted by more and more members of the far right and even the Republican Party as like a racial republic, you know, having a racial component to it. So those two things, I feel like the Great Reset conspiracism and the Great Replacement conspiracism are connected. But I thought that there was a good quote in here in your book, and I'm going to quote your book a lot because I like it. It's on page 27. In a society where the economy is privately controlled like ours, the neuroses of its owners tend to spread throughout society at large via the influence they exert over political and media institutions. It's like when the ruling class sneezes, we all get a cold. when profit rates, as we're going to talk about a lot in this episode, start to go down, and as competition more and more becomes zero sum, the ruling class gets a little wiggy trying to figure out different ways to maintain its rule, obviously its profits as well. And that kind of filters down through us. And maybe took a little bit of time from like 2008 through those green shoots that Obama talked about into like Trumpism 2015, 2016 now. But in a very real way, you're identifying this book like a conveyor belt of like ideology between the ruling class and dispersed through like various middle class segments, and even picking up some members of the working class in it. So talk a little bit about that. What is the relationship between these two?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the context of that passage that you cited, right, it's in the chapter on kind of like what was globalization. And the back, you know, when we think back to like the, you know, the halcyon days of like the early 2000s, late 90s, like high globalization, high neoliberal period, it was all about like efficiency, and you got to be competitive, and you got to work harder, and you got to, you know, you got to be the smartest, like sort of self-motivated, you know, guy on the block or whatever to get ahead in life, because that's the new playing field, right? It's this new, like this brave new world of globalized competition, where everybody has a shot at it, and it's all about your, you know, it's all meritocratic, basically. It's all about talent. It's all about how, what you can do to get ahead, for countries, for businesses, for individuals, whatever. And yeah, and so when you look at the actual like economic data from that period, though, like the macroeconomic data, the statistics, right? It's like the growth rates, you know, as I talk about in the book, like they're not all that great compared to, if you compare them to earlier periods that came before, and a number of ways you can measure that. And so what that ultimately, I mean, that discourse, right, of efficiency and competitiveness and the need to do whatever it takes to get ahead, all that classic globalization talk, that was part of the, you know, the neuroses, if you like, of the capitalist elite, sort of like, you know, enjoining the rest of us to work harder, to exploit ourselves more, to allow ourselves to be exploited more, to produce more surplus value for this system that actually already in the early 2000s was not running as potently as it had before. And so that's one example of it. I think a more recent example that probably everybody is familiar with is, of course, the new, you know, the bipartisan elite consensus around the need to confront China, of course, yes, in this country. And we don't have to necessarily dig right into that in this moment and save it for later if you like. But yeah, I mean, that to me is like a textbook case of just top-down manufactured consent in the interests of the most influential and powerful fractions of the ruling class, of the capitalist class, you know, who decided that the time for cooperation with Chinese companies and the government there was over, and it's time now for sort of renewed confrontation in the interest of not freedom and democracy and all this kind of stuff, but just straight up corporate profits. You know, they started to lose out to Chinese businesses, and they decided that it was time to enlist the long arm of the state in their favor. And once that process, which took a long time to kind of settle in, right, then you start to see the political consensus form, where more and more politicians begin to line up on behind this agenda, because, you know, they're corporate benefactors, like it benefits them, therefore it benefits their electoral prospects, because of this kind of pay-to-play way that politics works in Washington, among other things. It's a fantastic way to deflect blame from yourself, right? Like all the failures of the American state, all of its like embarrassing, you know, humiliations over the last 10 years, especially the pandemic, the response to the pandemic.
Oh, I mean, God, yeah.
That was the moment where I think the whole world was just looking at this country and was like, dear God, you know, like we can't look to these people anymore as like as some kind of paradigm of leadership.
It was somehow both like authoritarian, but also like feckless at the same time. And it was like, there was disinformation flying everywhere, but like in such an authoritative way that it was really, it was really like blindsided all of us, I feel like. And you're right. That was like a real moment of not just social turmoil that we're still dealing with the wreckage of. And as the founding member of ILC Chicago, you know what's happened to social life since the pandemic. But just as you said, too, just on an administrative level, what a delegitimization of what like the efficient state is meant to do, you know?
Absolutely. And so that was, and it was around then, I mean, the anti-China discourse had, of course, been percolating and it was present in public life until 2020, but it really went into overdrive.
Absolutely. In 2020.
And, you know, the China virus and like all that stuff. And so, and ever since then, it's just been this ratcheting, you know, this program of ratcheting up military and economic tensions with that country. And so, yeah, the neuroses of the ruling class filter down into the rest of society. And now there's this lockstep media consensus, right?
Yeah.
In addition to the political consensus, that's just, it's just airtight on that issue, right? Anyway, so that's a couple of examples of what I mean by that.
Yeah, you bring up Thomas Friedman's argument that the world is flat, right? That was, what, 2006, I think? Amazing time to write a peon to globalization, right? As it's about to reach its terminal crisis. Perhaps the American Empire's terminal crisis, too, but that awaits to be seen. I wonder how he feels right now, because the world isn't flat, but Gaza is. You have... what substituted for the legitimizing sort of national project or like defense project of the global war on terror at the same time as like this deglobalization really kicks into speed, this new economic nationalism, all of a sudden, as you point out in the book too, it's no longer international networks of jihadist terrorists that we have to worry about, but it's revisionist states. And of course, Russia being number one among them after the war in 2022. But of course, China now gets accused after making hundreds of billions, perhaps trillions of dollars for American corporations, outsourcing much of their production, lending them the technology they need in order to make them all that money. Now China has suddenly become a revisionist state as well. So this is like the shift that we're looking at here is not just an ideological one. It's like a substantive one across all facets of society. And like you said, it's like for those of us born and raised in like the go-go 90s, for example, right? When Thomas Friedman's views, when the globalized views of globalization were basically like hegemonic, we very seamlessly sort of transitioned into a new series of villains, but also like a new series of policy, a basket of policy proposals, which include all sorts of things that would have been anathema to these people 20 years ago. And yet, except for your books and broadly books on like the Marxist left, it doesn't seem like there's been much sort of self-analysis here, right? Like, I feel like they need a good fucking psychiatrist or something like that. Somebody needs to sit these people down and fucking tell Matty Glacius, like, you've lost the plot, man.
It just, yeah, the whole thing just runs on, it's almost like it runs on amnesia or something. It's like,
yeah,
it's like the condition, like the job description is like, you have to have a severe case of selective memory and forgetting. And so that you can't think any further than like 5 or 6 years in the past, you know, and they just, yeah, there's, that goes, you know, For the commentators and the pundits and the politicians and the elites as well, it's just like there's no desire to reflect on any of this stuff and look back and think about, well, wait, what, why did it go terribly wrong? You know, like what, like the consensus was that it was going to be this thing, and then it really turned out to be something totally different, and everyone who was supposed to know what the hell they were talking about the benefits of globalization and trade liberalization and the spread of human rights and, you know, the appeal of liberal democracy and all of that, it all turned out to be total nonsense.
Yeah.
And so there's just, but again, because of the, I would argue it's because of the relentless pace of the, you know, the capitalist crisis cycle, that it just, it keeps them, their vision can only be like right in front of their, right in front of their nose. And they can't, they don't have time to really look back and think about history that much, because it's just, you know, it's just constantly putting out fires. And the need to, yeah, to guide this extremely crisis-ridden social formation that is only getting worse.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me ideologically of the way you describe later on in the book, the way the Federal Reserve operates, how central banks operate. You know, there's no time for thinking. You just have to do, like, throw whatever you can at the wall, whatever policy is necessary, go back to Volcker, go back to fucking 1913, in order to try to figure out some way just to keep price stability, make sure that American assets in the trillions, like dollar denominated assets, retain their value. And or merging, it's just sort of putting out fires.
Or a more recent example, merging with BlackRock.
Right. Yeah, they're doing their bond system for them, right?
Yeah.
What do you know about
that? Yeah, they've been. I mean, the partnership with BlackRock goes back to, I think, as far back as 2008. They were already working with BlackRock and to structure the bailout then. But 2020 was when they really worked very closely with BlackRock to, you know, create the, like, the Fed was working with BlackRock to create the, like, the investment vehicles and, like, the weird, you know, financial instruments that like structured the whole bailout of the banks and the corporate sector more broadly. And, you know, I mean, yeah, the bankers or the asset managers, whatever you want to call them, they basically just tell the Fed what to do. And the Fed is like, you know, all right. And because again, like the global economy is on the verge of collapse, and they don't, you know, they really don't know what they're doing at the end of the day. So yeah, that, so it's a really good example of that, like, close, that really, like, fusion of economic and political power that, like, really defines the highest level of the power structure, the political economy, and the capitalist order that we're in.
You use an analogy to the Kafka novel, The Castle, later on in the book too, which is really powerful too. It's like this sense of alienated power that Kafka creates, this sense in the book that there's, like, important people somewhere administrating society, doing important tasks. They're always shuffling paper around. And eventually the question arises, like, are these people actually doing anything? Is this just a self-perpetuating bureaucracy for the sake of bureaucracy? I mean, that's not what the government does, right? Talk a little bit, but it is sort of how it appears sometimes. Talk a little bit about the capitalist state. And it's a big question, like, through history. I want to get into your critiques of the works of Michael Hudson, because I think they're really important, and also of the Keynesians and MMT, which has kind of disappeared, much to Varn's happiness, I think. Mm-hmm. But first, like, let's get down to maybe some like rudimentary shit. Like, the capitalist nation state is counterposed often to, like, the self-ordering functions of the free market. And the contradiction between these two things have kind of bedeviled theorists of capital, whether of the right or left, since the very beginning, because they seem to be working at cross purposes. But you have a more rich sort of dialectical view of this. So in this new rising realm of economic nationalism, what is the state doing? Specifically the American state, but the state in general.
I mean, yeah, so states are doing a lot of different things right now to try to, like, make their way through this period of fundamental uncertainty and instability that increasingly is defined by a very dangerous vacuum, I think, in global power and leadership, as, you know, as the U.S. continues to sort of delegitimate itself now through this, you know, reckless genocidal war that it's expanding across the Middle East through its client state.
Yeah.
And through its, you know, just, like, brazen willingness to weaponize its financial system, right, against its geopolitical enemies, and the monetary and payment system against its enemies. There's just a lot of doubt with state actors around the world about, you know, how are things going to shape up? Who should you ally with? Who should you stay away from? Who's going to come out on top of all this? As you know, the U.S. is clearly it's raging against the dying of the light, but it's pretty clear what direction things are going in, right? So, you know, I try to resist the just staying the state, right? Like the capitalist state in a kind of general sense. Sometimes I prefer to look at specific cases as much as I can, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the general function of the capitalist state, one could venture a definition, is to mind the needs of capitalist accumulation at the same time to preserve its sense of its image of popular legitimacy in the eyes of its own population.
Right.
And there are many different kind of takes and theoretical directions of that central kind of thesis, but that's what the capitalist state has to do. The problem is that there's almost always, but there is built in a tension, a conflict between these two objectives, because of course the capitalist state is a class formation. All states in the modern capitalist world are class states, which means they reproduce themselves by extracting surplus value from one class and enriching the other class with it, the owners. And that is how the economies grow and reproduce themselves. And so at this point, you know, so many things can go wrong. I mean, if the rate of labor productivity, for instance, starts to go down, then that means that labor costs begin to eat other things being equal, eat into corporate profits, because for whatever reason, labor is more expensive than it used to be. And that then creates larger problems of growth and profit growth, which means that the overall economic pie, right, is not as big and can't be distributed. There's not as much value or wealth to distribute to the rest of society. And the more that the macroeconomic crises afflict the capitalist economy like that, of course, the more that the legitimacy problem, you know, comes into play, and the more difficult it is for the elite class to run the country, to run the government credibly. And so that's kind of the general outline of it. In the U.S. case, you know, the inequality, the really savage inequality between the sort of wealth and asset owning class and the rest of the working class had gotten so extremely bad by after 2008 and the kind of aftermath of the great global crash of 2008 and the recovery from it, right? The very techniques that the state uses in its attempt to recover from capitalist crisis exacerbates the same problem, right? So inequality just got even worse following the great crash of 2008. After they, you know, from the bailout and from the austerity and from all the sort of gimmicks that they try to throw at the problem to fix it. And of course that leads to the huge political problem, right? The mm-hmm. rise of the right-wing populist challenge to state, to the very legitimacy of the state, right? Like think back to Trump in 2016. He's really kind of lost his edge these days, but
he has, yeah.
You know, when he was running in 2016, it was all about he talked a little bit about trade, but it was mostly just about making fun of the other people in the election, you know?
That was great fun. I wasn't a Trump fan, but it was great fun to watch him dispatch them one by one, just with cutting remarks and biting satire.
Yeah, yeah, same. I mean, none of us are Trump fans, right? But it's you have to be able to laugh at this shit at the end of the day.
Otherwise, you cry.
Yeah, and so, but that's he was just the living embodiment of the delegitimation of the American state. You know, like he was just up there like flinging insults left and right, and people loved it. He was breaking that taboo, right? And the reason he was able to do that is because the conditions in American society have gotten so bad that people are so angry and just furious at the failures of the political system that all you have to do is just make the politicians, you know, look like the sort of venal cretins that they are, and people will eat it up.
Oh yeah. Big time. And the more high-minded message of Bernie Sanders that we might have like a political revolution, that you could create like a top-down sort of like progressive return to welfarist policies is, of course, as we know now, certainly in retrospect, but people like us called it at the time, was sort of the mirror image of Trumpism. Not that that he was odious like Trump was, but it was very much a backwards looking and very much kind of like an ersatz populist movement on both sides that attempted to kind of break through the logjam of capitalist politics in the United States in a moment when they weren't working, which I think is a good moment to bring up the sort of bipartisan basis of economic nationalism, right? Because industrial policy is back on the menu. The trade war that Trump fitfully imposed upon China and our own steel producers, as it turned out too, became bipartisan under Biden. Certainly his Inflation Reduction Act, which was like a massive subsidy program giveaway to capital in order to kind of spur investment in a brute sort of way, in like an old like 20th century industrial policy sort of way, led, I would say, a lot of the people who now recognize him rightly as a genocide heir, or at least a supporter and a helper of genocide in Gaza, to call him the most left-wing president, you know, in American history. So there's a way in which large segments of the left, the social democratic left, the Keynesian left, indeed, maybe even the Michael Hudson left, whatever that left is, the American Communist Party left, recognize that the state has, in their mind, an important role to play, and that national competition is the game of the hour. So talk a little bit about the left in economic nationalism, how the left has gotten there, broadly the left, like everywhere from like center left Democrats all the way to like, you know, supposed mm-hmm. communists, and how it mirrors or how it differs maybe from the right.
Yeah, I mean, we can take Michael Hudson, I guess, right?
Let's do it. He's popular these days. Let's take him down a couple pegs.
Yeah, just as a point of departure, like, because, like, so I haven't read much of his over the last couple of years, like since I finished the book, you know. So I don't know if his positions have changed. I suspect they haven't. But he wrote this book called Super Imperialism, right? Which is like this descriptive take on the way that U.S. power, U.S. imperial power has evolved through its financial system, of course, and particularly how after the divestment from the gold standard and the, I mean, I think the book even, he wrote it even before, I think, the separation of the dollar from gold, but then he sort of supplemented it later, looking back afterward, to expand the argument sort of. But his argument essentially is that, right, like, because the role of U.S. debt is so essential, and the U.S. dollar is so essential in global money markets and financial markets as a form of investment, the U.S. has the ability to, of course, you know, fund its insane and reckless global empire endlessly, because it can always rely on this global demand for its state debt and for dollar assets, for investment flowing into the country, because, you know, its currency is the most valuable currency in the world. It's the most high demand. It's the most used. And it's just seen globally as like the safest, the world's global reserve asset, right? Like the safest asset you can have, dollar assets. And so because of the unique status, the exorbitant privilege, right? Mm-hmm. To use that phrase, yeah, of the dollar, the U.S. can fund its maniacal global military empire, essentially, and its global system of state coercion and exploitation of other states. And so that, you know, that's pretty true, right? Like, there's not much to disagree with there. But
you said that in the very beginning that his analysis was descriptive, which for people who don't know Marxist jargon much, that's like derogatory. Parentheses, derogatory.
Yeah, that's true. And that's how I meant it, actually.
Oh, good. I was hoping so. Yeah. I thought I picked up on that.
So the problem is that he takes that description and draws the conclusion that like the traditional capitalist, the motor, right, of capitalist economy and the exploitation of labor and the extraction of surplus value doesn't apply anymore. Mm. And the whole global economy is just this sort of static, monolithic, like US, you know, financial and political order imposed on the rest of the world. Just basically one country exploiting the rest of the world, and that the problem is purely just U.S. imperialism. There's no other real imperial actors in the world. You know, inter-imperial competition is not so much a thing. It's just basically the U.S. exploiting the rest of the world. And so, you know, again, it's fine, but it then leads him in his more recent stuff to valorize in this kind of, like, I'll use the word productivism, right? It's very often in the sort of left anti-finance crowd, right? You see this counterposition or this opposition between bad finance on one side and, you know, capitalist production good on the other side.
Yeah.
And there's this, that's why Hudson and others valorize China always, right, as some kind of like model for 21st century socialism. They see that country as providing, as like kind of the antithesis of U.S. super imperialism. You know, it's like forging the path into socialism for the 21st century or whatever. But it just erases, you know, the sphere of production as a site of exploitation and value extraction
and struggle,
of course, class struggle. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Class conflict. You know, this is the, and that's the result of thinking that the product, that it's all sort of finance and politics driven. You know, and that like the categories of class and value, surplus value production no longer apply. You make those kind of basic analytical errors. And so, you know, so he's just he's a particularly clear example of that.
Reminds me in Capital Volume 3, Marx has this point about how the productive capitalist feels like the worker, and he sees the financial capitalist as the capitalist.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, so you, like you point out, you see this in both left and right critiques of finance capital. I wonder if what they're getting wrong is, and I think you mentioned this in the book, so tell me if I'm reading you right, is that there's this perception that the finance capitalists have too much political power, and they're imposing their own political preferences and wills, either as schemers or as just, you know, rich people with their own ideology onto the rest of the world at the expense of, like,
parentheses, elites,
sure,
globalists, yeah.
Or, you know, the 99% slogan of Occupy Wall Street has kind of this implication too. What do you think that gets wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, for one thing, that is kind of where it begins to overlap a little bit with the sort of the Great Reset narratives that we were talking about earlier, in the sense that you're locating the source of the social evil, right? Like the the source of social problems and ills, political dysfunction and all of that, just in a particular group of people that is really, at the end of the day, just one fraction of this much, they're a very powerful fraction, but they're just one fraction of this much bigger capitalist class, right, that like spans the world and is divided into different jurisdictions and national territories and allegiances and all of that, and whose nation states are constantly struggling to like, you know, organize them into a class, right, like, to make them like a coherent actor. It's like, you know, the like capitalists, we do refer to the capitalist class because that's what they are, but they all are constantly undercutting each other and antagonizing each other and acting in their own self-interest. They form alliances and, you know, obviously trusts and stuff like that. But it's an incredibly anarchic and chaotic sort of class situation there. And like the role of the capitalist government is to, the government of capitalist states is to try to organize all that chaos, right, into a coherent class. That's one of the other tasks of the capitalist state. And so I think that this idea that it's just like this one, like, you know, privileged elite group of people imposing its will on not just people, but like, you know, the entire rest of the capitalist, or the productive capitalist, the transport capitalist, like, you know, merchant capital, all of that. Even though all these things are kind of financially intertwined. And states as well. Like, I think that's it's too reductive a point of view. But that's not to say that it's politically not useful, right? Which is why I think, you know, for all its faults, you know, the 99% versus the 1%, for its moment, you know, it did some work, right? It did some ideological work. It helped to like focus the energy and the anger of large numbers of people against, you know, a true enemy, which is like the banker class who was getting bailed out, you know, in those years.
It was a very specific and concrete political question at that time, right? There was still talk of attempting to claw back the bonuses of those bankers. There was still some talk about bailing out homeowners who were increasingly at that point being foreclosed upon and bankrupted. I mean, the most plausible, it's not the Hudson view, it's actually quite far from the Hudson view. The most plausible sort of analysis, and one that you share in this book, is you have to raise the question, like, why? Why financialization? Why all of a sudden? Was it just like a power move, a political move by like globalists and like powerful financiers to craft the American state into a financialization machine, in some nefarious way to like deindustrialize America or whatever? And therefore, is it just a political choice we make to euthanize the rentiers once again, as Deng did? I don't know. You're mixing it up with China, right? But like, the point is that analysis, I feel like, leads to bad politics. The real important question is like, why? What is it about capitalism that this massive shift occurred? And you point out, I think rightfully, we should all agree with this, that this giant surplus of financialized assets and instruments flying around is a reflection of the tangential secular decline of the rate of profit, and the financial system being the way that surplus is basically distributed within the capitalist class amongst its actors across space, across time, within sectors and without sectors, right? Means that all that financial shit sloshing around points to a dysfunction in the productive profit system itself. These two things are two moments, you know, in the cycle of commodity production, money and commodities in a very abstract way. And so I feel like any communist who takes their politics from like the Michael Hudson view of things automatically is on the back foot, because they think it was a political decision to get us into this mess of globalization, and as though it's like just takes a purposive political movement to get you out of this mess, as though we could simply return to the mass worker of the 1950s in the United States, as though it's possible to go backwards in time. off my soapbox now, but that's what pisses me off about like this ML, like, you know, get rid of finance, bring back productive jobs, American Communist Party shit. Beyond being like vulgarized, I also find the politics of it to be very unappealing. As someone that works in industry, even I find it unappealing.
Right on. Yeah. I mean, we should be thinking about how to make, you know, all forms of work less shitty. You know, it's not about like returning to an earlier shitty form of labor,
right?
Labor regime. Yeah.
Totally.
And of course, thinking strategically about, you know, workplaces as sites of class conflict and strategy, right? Not just sort of writing them off and assuming that we can socialize investment at the top, right, as the Keynesians want. And, you know, we're just going to get some really smart elites who somehow can overcome the opposition of the entire capitalist class to take control of the financial system and like redirect and reinvest all of that money into unprofitable, socially useful sources, right? It's like, okay, you can believe in that and you can think that that's like, you know, it's useful to come up with. I still think it's valuable for people to come up with ideas for what this could look like and what like new forms of socialized investment could look like if and when we're ever in a position to be able to do that kind of project. But like, there's no class power or social power, you know, in view right now that could possibly kind of force that agenda into political action. So, I think that it misses a much more a prior question of social and political organization that needs to be addressed.
Yeah. Which maybe our ILC might be some small part of bringing the sort of politics necessary to do that out to the fore, because the idea that in our particular like constellation of state forces that exist right now, our constitutional order, our federal order, that one could be elected into a position where like Dungism could be applied to the United States seems kind of wild, right? I feel like in order to have a sort of even a social revolution of that character, an economic revolution of that character, you would need millions, tens of millions of workers activated to do things besides pulling the lever on a voting booth every 2, 4, 6 years.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the work right now as I see it.
Indeed. So, Andy, you had a question about the George Floyd stuff towards the end, right?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that you included a pretty nice depiction of what the George Floyd uprising looked like in Chicago. And you've got, in your analysis of it, it kind of ended through state repression and co-optation from the Democrats and the NGOs. I've got a little bit of a different interpretation of it, but I was wondering why you included that in the book. Like, what role do you think that, say, it wasn't repressed or co-opted and it pushed farther one way or another? Like, what kind of role do you think it could have in this end game narrative?
I mean, I did try to point out that, like, it's, you know, the entire like vertical dimension, what I call the vertical dimension of politics, was missing from that whole episode, right? And that it was repressed and sort of tempered by the NGO complex. But I didn't mean to suggest that that was purely what happened. I mean, the movement itself had its own limitations that it wasn't able to, like, internally, right? It wasn't able to constitute itself as an enduring social force. Mm-hmm. But the reason I wanted to kind of write that last chapter in that, like, you know, kind of first person, at least the opening, in that kind of narrative mode and in that kind of phenomenological, you know, like what it looked like, what it felt like, you know, how it looked like to the participants, right? Like, was to sort of like draw out that sense of like utopian possibility that was lodged in that moment, that at least I felt for like a week or so there, right? Like marching in the streets and running from cops at seeing, you know, incredible courage and bravery from comrades during that period. It was that sense where, like, I think I describe it in the book, like time was expanding. You know, it was like, okay, this isn't the time for everyday activities. This isn't the time for work or you know, every like that kind of, this is the time to be doing something else that's like way more important and that trumps our other everyday obligations. And like millions of people felt that same thing, you know? And so I wanted to like, that's really what I wanted to get. It's like to draw what that felt like in that moment. Because that's part of the, you know, the explosive core of that kind of moment in history. But yeah, as far as what it could have accomplished, I mean, I don't know. I feel like, yeah, because we weren't adequately prepared in an organizational sense to capture the momentum of a moment like that. There was only so far it was able to go at the end of the day. I think, but then on the other hand, I mean, there's a sense in which like, my sense of it is that we're never going to be fully equipped to harness a moment of that, of power like that. Right. Where like, I mean, it's just the scale is maybe beyond what we can hope to sort of like, you know, hit ourselves to and move forward organizationally, if and when we ever have organizations in place, with a radical agenda that we like, you know, like guiding them. Like, so yeah, I think that's why I kind of see it more as like, I guess I would say a dialectic between organization and struggle, right? It's like, we do have these moments of massive social, you know, explosive rage, which by the way, even though it's been fairly quiet for the last couple of years, you know, they, like those problems have not gone away.
Yeah.
It will come back around, right? As Rage Against the Machine says, it's coming back around. it's just a matter of time. People remember that struggle, right? They remember being in moments like that. They remember the defeats of the sort of neo-social democratic electoral project that kind of led up to that moment too. And I just think people are looking, you know, people on the left, radically minded individuals, groups, organizations are looking for, you know, the next step. They're looking for the way forward. But now that we've entered this kind of moment of confusion and demobilization, you know, broadly across the left. And anyway, that's a very long, convoluted answer to your question, Andy. But like, basically, yeah, I think we need to work on building organizations that could better take advantage of moments like that.
You say demobilization on the left, but there's a massive campaign for Harris and Waltz right now, man. I don't know what you're talking about. There's people knocking on doors. There's signs going up. I'm getting like all sorts of spam in my email box. That's the weird thing about elections, man. It's like everything's already like negative partisanship anyway. And I read the news, like various different news sites every day, whether it's election season or not. And even like a quote unquote really important election like this just seems like extra. It's just like more of the same bullshit, like forced to choose sides between two different groups and two different visions of economic nationalism. And you're meant to like make some moralistic distinction between these two things. And there is like actual morality there, right? But like, oh boy, it feels good to check out. I don't know if you guys are particularly checked out right now, but it feels pretty good. Andy, I know, is a big elections guy, but.
Yeah, I figure it's like part of the job to some extent. It has been really hard to keep interested as Harris just drifts farther and farther right, just like branding herself as a Republican. And I think you put it well when you were talking about the sort of neoliberalism of the Democratic Party leading to the George Floyd uprising in some way, because you know, as much as people say that the Democratic Party just harnessed the George Floyd uprising to elect Biden, the uprising itself was completely disinterested in the election. Like the election kind of just stopped. Nobody cared about it. That was maybe one of the openings there that we could have just maybe if the that political moment had lasted longer, whether in a riot or some other form, we could just the rejection would just the election itself would be delegitimized, and maybe a new kind of politics would come out of it. But I just thought it was such an interesting thing to cap the book with, because it's you know, it's hard now to, you know, I was in a group that was trying to understand the George Floyd uprising, and it was very hard to square the intensity of that moment with like the gap of struggle that came after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I still think that's a riddle that we haven't really broached yet.
Well, yeah. A lot of people, and I think for good reasons, tie like the rise of the Bernie Sanders candidacy to the kind of after effects of Occupy Wall Street. And so the thing about history is like a lot of people are done with the history of the George Floyd uprising, but might not be done with them, might not be done with us yet. You know, like I see to like abstract away a little bit from that moment, we're talking about 2020. We're talking about like an explosion of social activity, sometimes violent, certainly angry in revulsion of this delegitimized order. Well, there's been a lot of those recently, right? It's part of like these various different paroxysms of like a world system, not just in decay, but in the process of attempting to become something else. And I always wondered as I got into the topic of like regimes of accumulation, if you want to call them, or like periods of capitalist development from like laissez-faire to the progressive period to the roaring 20s to the New Deal to Fordism, blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, what would it have been like to live through that in the 1970s? Well, this is what it's like to live through it. I wonder if all of us like can even maybe think about whether and this is a dark idea, but like in the 70s with the transition, 70s and 80s with the transition from one regime of accumulation to neoliberalism, there are all sorts of incumbent actors out there. And I'm specifically thinking of like environmental groups like NYPERG, or especially trade unions in the United States, these incumbent like civil social institutions that fought tooth and nail against the sort of transition towards globalization, if you want to call it that. It doesn't feel like, and maybe this is part of why it feels like no debate has been had within the ruling class or within the punditry or the media or the citizenry, because it doesn't feel like there are great incumbents right now who are attempting to stop this, like the shift away from globalization. Is that something that's different from like say the 1970s? Certainly the 1930s, you know, was a time of great social contestation. Like, how do we look at this transition period, and how long is it going to go on for? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean it's a really good question. Question that we could ask is like, you know, the model of I guess our mental picture kind of how we want to think about what's unfolding, what we're living through right now. Is it a transition to another regime of accumulation, right? In the way that Great Britain handed the reins to the U.S. earlier in the 20th century, and then people thought the U.S. was going to go down the drain in the 70s, but the, right. You know. Obviously, it's held on, and it is able to capitalize on its on the renovation of its currency in order to, you know, build a whole new lease on life, essentially, as the global hegemon in this new financialized order. You know, that's a question I've asked myself. Like, okay, so like 40, 50 years ago. When the great crisis of the 70s was happening, and all these, you know, it was much more contested, much more militant. There was, like you said, like way more social resistance to the what was then the emerging project of neoliberalism. You know, is this going to be another moment where people are sort of calling time on the U.S. led order and U.S. power, but yet somehow it finds a way to kind of, you know, muddle through and again find another lease on life somehow by it would have to do something like reconstitute capitalist growth globally on a new basis, the way that it was able to do after the after the crisis of the 70s and the taming, you know, Paul Volcker's subduing of inflation and the great crisis, the defeat of the working class, the industrial working class, and the regime of financial growth and extreme inequality that they sort of built on top of that. That's the question we'd have to answer is like, is there, if it is going to transition into another US-led form of international order, what is the economic basis for that going to be? And right now, I mean, all we can do is sort of look out from our vantage point we're in, and all I see is something of a replay of the pattern that set in when Great Britain went into when the order of international capitalism that was sort of managed and superintended by Great Britain in the 19th century, early 20th century, went into its great and final crisis, and countries began to individually pursue their self-interest aggressively at the expense of others, leading to, of course, you know, to global wars and the deaths of tens of millions of people. I'm not saying it's going, or hundreds of millions. I'm not saying it's heading in exactly that direction, but it's not clear to me what the basis will be for a new, you know, if we want to call it like a regime of accumulation, but some kind of economic basis for broad growth that would get buy-in from most of the population and sort of re-legitimize the political order without triggering some kind of cataclysmic military conflict, you know, between these economic competitors on the global stage. And I mean, you know, I know I don't have to tell you guys this, but I think what's happening in the Middle East right now is like the US has essentially kind of like tacitly signed on to basically allowing Israel, the IDF, to pursue whatever objectives it wants in that region, in the pursuit of an attempt to kind of renovate, shake up the entire regional order.
Yeah.
In a way that would have seemed quite unimaginable maybe like 10 or 15 years ago, you know, just totally taking the leash off and being like,
the last, the last year in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon, and the last 3 years in Eastern Europe have been a series of like, I can't believe that we're seeing this happen over and over again, more and more red lines being crossed. You know, what's happening in the Middle East right now is like a self-demolition of the rules-based international order, like an auto coup against the order that, in a broad sense, the American ruling class set up, the architecture, right, of sovereign nation states, of borders, of, you know, the United States. This is where, again, I depart from the Hudson thing, and where, and this, I think, dovetails with the questions that you're asking, which I think are the really important ones. It's like Joe Biden said in the 1970s about Israel, if Israel didn't exist, we'd be forced to create it, right? If the United States empire, if the architecture of empire that Michael Hudson describes, since the 1930s and 40s, right, let's say, and has prevailed for almost 100 years since then, if it didn't exist, something like that would have to exist, right? We know this because there are cycles, imperial cycles, reserve currency cycles, capitalist architecture cycles that go up and down and span through the history of capitalism over hundreds and hundreds of years. And there's always been that sort of linchpin for accumulation that that one sovereign body that leads to the architecture of exploitation and oppression and domination and violence, but also of some sort of relative stability for a generation or two, right? In the United States' case, like 4 or 5 generations, I guess, at this point. But like, it's not clear to me, for the exact same reasons that it's not clear to you, what replaces this particular regime of accumulation. The only things that I can come up with are, as you said, increasing, as we're seeing already, inter-imperialist rivalry, the formation of quasi-mercantilist blocks. Of course, the BRICS on the one hand in the United States, that might be overblown, but it is a thing and it's something to look at in like a more substantive sort of like, what would the material substratum, what would the politics, what would the policy look like in a place like the United States? It's a dark one. It's like AI, massive investments in AI, like sucking entire countries worth of energy to answer stupid questions so that you can automate away every paralegal, every secretary, like half the white collar jobs that exist. Robotics, as Elon Musk is trying to do, they're not there yet, replacing a lot of the service work, automated cars and trucks, replacing a lot of the driving jobs and logistics jobs. And then you'd, of course, to have legitimacy, the ruling class would be forced to have, and it would look like a leftist thing, something like a UBI, like a guaranteed income thing. And we'd all be not in like 1984, but some sort of Brave New World thing. And already you're seeing now, and this is part of what the ILC is attempting to try and fight, this real evacuation of the political sphere, but also the social sphere too. Like the last time the United States, last time NATO tried to put nuclear-tipped intermediate nuclear weapons in Germany, it was the 1980s, and millions upon millions of Germans came out against NATO and American imperialism and militarism out of the self-interested idea that they don't want to be the first ones blown up in a global thermonuclear war. Well, now these same things are happening without a fucking peep, and it's got to scare the shit out of you, right? Like, it feels like the end game of the last 50 years has been the absolute liquidation and evacuation of not just politics, but like social life, like the ability to think politically about the future, except in some sort of conspiracist way or some sort of like center left, like, well, everything has to get better, right? Sort of way. And without an alternative to that, I don't see how World War III doesn't happen. Or I don't see how we're all not just like, instead of the rentiers being euthanized, we're all sort of euthanized into some grim, like Brave New World type future. Sorry to be pessimistic, but that's what it feels like at this point.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I share many of those same anxieties. I mean, yeah, I always try to check myself and think like, okay, so yeah, again, like back in the 70s or something, right? Or, you know, another crucial moment, like the 30s, you know, where like people had the subjective sense that they were living, they had to like think and believe they were living through these crazy unprecedented events, right? That like where red lines were being crossed and like, you know, like alarming events were happening at an increasingly accelerating rate. But it's like, I don't know, something about the present, like, I always come back and be like, something feels different now. It's like, there's just generally society is more subdued. People feel like they're out of options, or they think the political system has nothing for them and it's entirely useless. And there's just like, yeah, like you said, so many of these red flags are happening without a peep. And we got to do something about it, or try to at least. Yeah.
Well, that seems like a dour place to end it, except that a couple weeks ago, you guys had your first meeting in Chicago. How'd it go?
Yeah, we did. It went great. Yeah, we had more people turn out than I expected, considering how we didn't really advertise much at all for it. But yeah, you called it out on the show, and we had a couple social media posts up for it. And so we had like 14 people show up, I think. And, you know, we have others who are interested and we're getting in touch with and following up with. But we're also discovering some other organizations in Chicago that are doing kind of similar-ish work.
Hell yeah.
And so we're meeting up, you know, connecting with them, and we're going to be learning from them and sort of vice versa. And I think, I don't know, like I said, I do think there's a hunger for some kind of way forward, you know, yeah, to put it that way, at least a vision that people can sign onto and throw themselves in with. And so that seems to be, it seems like we have a constituency for that, you know, in Chicago. Yeah. So I'm happy about it.
Yeah, we had a similar experience in New York, had about like 15, maybe 20 people at the first meeting, and then pretty quickly formed like a really solid core of like a dozen or two people who consistently show up. Like you guys, we kind of organically made connections with different groups like Plaza Proletaria, which is like a mostly a Mexican American group, which like did a big social and economic struggle around Sunset Park during the COVID pandemic, but is now like within the community there, like a civil social organization and like a revolutionary organization. We had people from like various left sectarian groups come by. We had the committee for a new socialist party that we've been working with too. So I think reaching out to other groups and like making ourselves known. There's when we were talking about doing something down south, our friend Scott Durbin of the rank and file electricians union movement told us that there is something called the Southern Workers Assembly, which is doing great work down in the South in a very anti-union environment and stuff. So there are green shoots, you know, like Obama told us in 2009, there are green shoots and there's reasons not to despair. And I don't think your book is a particularly despairing book. And I strongly encourage everybody out there to get it. Like I said, it reads really well and it's very, very insightful. And if you're ever looking at like economic news or looking at the news, you're looking at the conspiracism that's shooting around Elon Musk's Twitter X every single fucking day. It's completely overwhelming. The election's a fucking farce. Political democracy's falling apart. Society's alienated. Like this book helps to explain how that comes from, as you suspected, the breakdown and decay of this mode of production. And it's only through understanding that, as you do in this book, as you explain to us in this book, that we can really ever do anything about the real substantive problems that exist. So I'd shoot it to Andy for some final thoughts, but I couldn't recommend this book enough. So thank you so much for writing it.
Yeah,
thank you.
A plug adding to that is Jamie will be at Woodbine on November 23rd. That's a Saturday night.
Hell yeah.
So you can buy the book there and hear him talk and ask him questions. And I'll plug that again before then, but that's a November 23rd at Woodbine. And also the title of the book is Chess Reference, Endgame, and I'll try to add a somewhat optimistic note on top of that, which is that a saying in chess is, no one's ever won by resigning.
There you go.
So even if you're down resignation material, you got to play out the clock.
That's right. That's because what we're doing.
The enemy sometimes makes a big blunder.
Well, thanks again, Jamie. This has been great. And we'll see you in New York. We'll do like a meetup with ILC people. It'll be really, really fun. So until then. Yeah,
looking forward to it.
So long.
Looking forward to it. Thanks again, guys.